Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.
Ha huageshtig ri CGSF, Nachad Poing Aun FM, Crowley Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome everybody to another special interview session here on Vancouver FM on CGSF 90.1 FM, your source for chiptune, video game music, soundtrack, synthesized music, and tonight, 3D films featuring my special guest, Schnoodlebug. Welcome once again to the program.
Thanks for having me.
For those who don't know, can you talk about a certain 3D film that you have just premiered here in Vancouver?
Yeah, so last Saturday, that would have been December 10th, we showed the 3D version of my first animated flick, Roach. And I think it went well. What do you think?
I think it was pretty awesome because it's been a long time since I've actually wanted to go see a 3D film. Sometimes 3D.
Avatar 2 is out.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, but James Cameron has enough money to go hunt for Russian subs and the Titanic, so he's...
Oh, well, I appreciate it.
Yeah. But the fact that this was a one-man production really kind of sealed the deal for me. And also, for those who don't know, Schnoodlebug is the composer of the theme song to Vancouver FM. Good old Glückschmerz off of Pop 2. And there was some Schnoodlebug music featured in the film as well. So overall, I thought it was pretty great.
Oh, man, thank you. I appreciate that, especially coming from you. That's... Oof. No, I was so taken aback by how, I mean, we had over 50 people show up.
Was it sold out?
No, we kept increasing the capacity as we went.
Nice.
So,
nice.
Yeah, no, at that point, I think we could have fit 75, but that would have been a little stuffy in there, I think.
Totally.
At the amount it was.
Which you even had a few people sitting down on the floor, campfire style, watching the film.
I saw that. I felt so bad when I popped up from, because I was hiding in front of the projector. The projector was stationed on this slice of life, or slice next door has these modular kind of cubes on wheels that we had the projector kind of propped on with a tripod, and it had the mixer there, and I was kind of riding the levels from the bottom there. But it was also a really nice way to kind of keep myself from watching the audience too much.
Yeah, definitely, because then you can just focus on ensuring that it, because you do have an important job, which is a screening of a film and making sure that that goes off technically. And the fact that you have a 3D projector plus sound going to speakers as well, and a live musical performance as a bit of an overture too, so that was, it's quite a bit of technicality.
Absolutely, yeah. And that one, I'm sure we talked about it before. The last time we talked, I feel like I was so energized from the moment that the adrenaline. I don't remember a thing.
We'll replay that episode for the folks at home. Don't worry.
Good stuff. Probably sound pretty all over the place there, but yeah, no, it was a blast. It was an absolute blast.
Nice. Well, maybe let's go into the kind of production and the planning and the actual laying the groundwork of this film. So can maybe tell us kind of where the film started, what inspired you to choose the subject matter, as well as the format, as in how low res or high res you wanted it to go?
Sure thing. So the idea basically started with my buddy and I driving to and from film school, just kind of fantasizing about more of a Starship Troopers kind of movie, but the same sort of themes of polluting to the point of having to kind of live higher and higher to avoid corrosive atmosphere. Bugs, specifically cockroaches, kind of mutating with those changes and then coming up to feed once they've eaten everything in sight. So and that idea, sorry, go on.
Oh no, I was gonna say the one thing that I caught on the second viewing, because the movie is now available on YouTube in red format, so go check that out. Subscribe to Schnoodlebug channel, by the way.
Actually, not YouTube. It's on Instagram.
Oh, it's Instagram. Really? It's an Instagram movie. Oh, okay. Then get your phones out, ladies and gents.
I managed to upload the entire thing to Instagram. So if you have Instagram, at Schnoodlebug, S-C-H-N-U-D-L-B-U-G, Schnoodlebug, you'll be able to watch the entire 2D version, red version, original red version. Think of it like Pokemon. There's going to be more color variants in the future. So,
is there going to be one where the little cockroach goes behind you and you have to turn around and it's like, peek, peek up?
Yeah, we'll see. I don't want to do too much.
Yeah, no, that's actual, true.
But
that's
we do have alternate cuts planned. We have extended cuts.
Yes.
A bunch of stuff cooking. So, yeah, it's really exciting. But sorry, man, where was I?
The technicality, kind of where the film started and then where the first scenes of the movie came from.
Of course, thanks for getting me back on track. So we would talk about this movie, and it was more of something that was like a live-action film. Mm. But of course, we were going to a school that was basically pumping out grips or film sets more than it was, you know. The editing program was probably the best, or editing classes were the best part of it. Really learned a lot there and really honed my craft. Excuse me. But as for everything else, honestly, I learned way more from YouTube. And the one thing that the one benefit of film school was just meeting some lifelong friends, people that were at the screening, my buddy who I was driving to and from school with, coming up with this stuff. But, you know, over time, we would try certain things out. We would film it, mostly tests just to see what would look good. Mm-hmm. And nothing would really match what we had in our heads. Obviously, we were naive and we had much bigger ideas of what it could be in our heads, you know, much more epic. But, you know, but our tastes at the time were different as well. My tastes specifically have changed so much, you know, over time, and I've learned so much from different, you know, films that I've seen. So with that, you know, the themes might have stayed the same, but the kind of approach continued to change. And especially when I realized that it was getting harder and harder to convince people, you know, in your early to mid 20s, you know, everyone starts kind of figuring out their lives, right? Whether it's families or jobs or something, they don't really want to waste time making a movie. And so in that sense, I was kind of losing a lot of potential collaborators to just, you know, life, right? And so I realized I had to kind of learn a lot of this stuff on my own if I wanted to get anything done. So a lot of it came from necessity and this drive to just kind of get this story done, you know, and made into a film, no matter what.
The perseverance behind that, because you mentioned when we first spoke in depth about it, that it took 4 years to make this film, and that's no small amount of time. You know, that's a presidential term, so it's a you know, it's an investment of not only yourself but your emotion and your network as well. But here you have something substantial to stand for. It, like, you have a world premiere in the city that you know, I think Vancouver was the only place that Roach could have been premiered, because the concept and the format, and especially for me, the visuals are a big thing. We should talk about that next.
Absolutely.
The visuals for me sealed the deal, and being able to experience that depth of field just makes it more impactful.
Absolutely. And on that note, just the fact that, you know, everything is construction themed comes from early experiences of working on job sites and just seeing just growth, city growth like crazy. And, you know, the idea of the shipping containers being a key ingredient in the story, that was a really early thing. Became obsessed with shipping container architecture and stacked shipping containers.
Tiny homes and all that, yeah.
Absolutely. But even just like going to those places, like
don't they have one? There's one on Hastings.
Yes.
That's, yeah, and it's kind of after the port, but before the east side. So
absolutely,
it's past Pink Pearl. If for those dim sum heads who know what's up.
Hell yeah! My dad's favorite. We used to go there all the time.
Classic. You drive past Pink Pearl, and then on your right hand side, as you're looking out the port of Vancouver, you've got a massive shipping container block. Like I would say, there's easily 80 containers there.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's just it. You know, that became something where if we were to film it, that I just kept thinking, you know, we could film on construction sites, you know, yeah. Things like that, where we could utilize the shipping containers. If anything, if we had to accumulate a budget of some sort, shipping containers, or at least figuring out a way to shoot them, you know, stacked or otherwise, and figuring it out in post, you know, we were getting pretty creative with it in our ideas, but again, it just kind of remained ideas and tests. And it wasn't until I started learning animation, I started working in VFX as an assistant editor and eventually a VFX editor, and learning kind of in the back of my head, taking notes, you know, as I'm experiencing trying to remember what they would call it, but I'd be in the screening room and I'd be showing shots and just kind of absorbing how everyone was talking about them. And, you know, right down to how we organized and named our shots and the shot codes for everything. And, you know, I just took all of that, absorbed it and applied it as I would, you know, if it was a real movie.
Project organization is underrated. It really does help keep things in order. And I do a lot of audio work and audio editing, and it gets to be messy very quick if you don't keep your files in order, just because they're massive files and they're often specific things that you need to keep in order, assets, as we say in animation or gaming.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, especially when you have 16 versions of the same shot or asset or something, you have to date them and name every version.
Totally.
You know, it's tedious, but you just got to do it. Otherwise, yeah, it becomes a nightmare, an absolute nightmare.
What kind of programs did you use in your animation for the film?
So that is all After Effects to pull off the animation. A lot of the 3D assets were made in Blender.
Nice.
The Roach was made by my friend Brett McDonald, who I believe he used Maya to sculpt it. Nice. And then a friend of mine from when I was working in VFX, he's a 3D generalist named Brendan Doughty. He kind of broke that apart and helped to make it possible for me to make that within After Effects using Element 3D. The other stuff, the other elements, like the ship is basically a restructured ship, or what do you call that, a skid steer. Those little bobcats.
Yeah.
Which, another thing from construction sites, I would just look at those all day and just imagine them, like, how would you rebuild this as a spaceship? Kind of, you know, a real diesel punk kind of mentality. Yeah.
Nice. Rust and big fat exhausts and copper and iron and grates and metal and fabrication. Yeah, I dig it.
Which made it so much fun to produce the sounds for it.
Did you ever play the first Gears of War? Because that had a very heavy diesel punk vibe to me.
It's so funny you should mention that, because I've been thinking about how much I love the what is that? What would you call that genre? Cover shooters?
Yeah, I would say a third-person shooter is what I call it.
Yeah, and there was that stretch of time, and my buddies and I talk about it as, like, you know, it's right when Zack Snyder films were super popular, so they kind of mesh together, so you have that mentality in a lot of those games, but
so
the Kane and Lynch kind of stuff. Actually, funny enough, not to go on a tangent, But I just played for the first time ever Kane and Lynch 2, which somehow, and I might, you know, someone might really take offense to this, became one of my top 10 games of all time. Somehow.
I mean, people have wonderful choices for their top games, and a lot of the times it surprises me what ends up being a standout game for them. Like for me,
really,
I would say Gravity Rush 2, Katamari Damacy, Jet Set Radio Future are way up there. So, I mean, they're all cel-shaded, so I'm dating myself. In the same way, it's like there are waves of games that come out.
And I think it was just that time. I love that genre, so going back to it, I was playing it in between renders of... Roach, you know, that was the last game I played, and I beat it in a few hours. You know, it took a few days, but man, I mean, it's a short game. It's like 2.5-3 hours long.
That's fine.
And not to go on a tangent again, but it's like, I think with the way things are, I needed a game that treated gun violence as like an actual scary and horrific thing as opposed to like, you know, I don't want to play something where I'm shooting people and having fun. So I appreciated how it made me feel kind of scuzzy.
Totally. Totally.
And the aesthetic was wonderful. It just like really sticks to trying to mimic being a camcorder recording, you know, when you do headshots, it pixelates and stuff like that. And it kind of just plays into, you know, I might be making movies, but I love any time the two formats kind of blend. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of play off the rules of each one in that way.
You can break the format fourth wall.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's very, very cool. Very cool. So,
a film is beautiful, but without sound, it is not a motion picture. So maybe, can you talk about some of the technology and the software that you use to create the soundtrack for the film?
Sure thing. When I was back in film school, I was asked to do the score for a short film called Night of the Mullets.
Nice.
I've tried to find it online. It's not online anymore. I see it on IMDb, but...
Archive.org, Wayback Machine.
Maybe, yeah.
That's my recommendation as a Bay Area native. Go check out Archive.org, gloriously hosted in San Francisco.
It's a beautiful, beautiful website. It's where I get a lot of movies for our movie nights. It's crazy. Beauty. Yeah, so anyways, where was I? Sorry.
just talking about some of the instruments and the sound that helped to create the soundtrack.
Yeah, we were working, I was working on this, and I used it as an opportunity to learn Ableton.
Nice.
So I've had the same copy of Ableton Live 8 since I took the opportunity to get the educational license, like, you know, what is it, like 13 years ago at this point. And I've never deviated from that copy of Ableton. And that's always been kind of the brain for my music and all this stuff. So when it came to scoring this, I didn't want to deviate too far from that or learn something new. So I had the movie in Ableton and then recorded using pretty haphazardly modded Korg Monotribe that I've been kind of tinkering with over the years, and it's a noisy beast, mostly because of really bad wiring on my part. I think I discussed it at the Q&A, but there's so many little quirks and little mistakes in the thing, like if you tweak the snare just a little too far past like the nine o'clock dial, the feedback gets so crazy you have to shut the whole thing off. And so most of the sounds, I would say 95% of the sounds, were made on that Monotribe. Her name is Monica.
Love it.
I love her, she's great. Still making music with her. Yeah, no, she's the best.
I have an Electribe ESX-1 from like 99, 2000, and it's all hardware with the tubes and the old school format cards. So but the thing is, because it was made 20 plus years ago, it's got hardware, you know, what's the word? Idiosyncrasies, just like Monica has. So ESX and Monica, you know, it's just, they understand that kind of this older hardware just comes with these you know, lifestyle choices electronically, to put
especially
it one
when,
way.
When you're not good with a soldering iron, So I used a lot of those idiosyncratic kind of things that I could get out of the, or sounds I could get out of Monica and utilize them in the movie. All the feedback, all of the rumbling, the low kind of tones, the
nice.
Everything else was created in Ableton using free VSTs.
Yeah.
So I would say 5% of the sounds, yeah, like the dub siren. That I've been using pretty much as one of my main instruments this whole time. I use that for more of the alarm sounds, and then I have like a Speak and Spell VST.
Yeah, I heard some.
And, yeah, I use that for
the cow goes moo.
For the danger that keeps repeating from the billboard. So yeah. Other than that, it's all Monica. It's all this crazy little analog synthesizer.
The fact that you can hear the truly electronic nature of the soundtrack fits so perfectly with the visuals, and the fact that it's in 3D too, it really, you know, it was a spectacle more than just a screening for a lot of people that I talked to that were there and saw the film.
Hopefully not the last time.
I want more screenings, and also, you know, I think maybe, you know, some kind of distribution, either digitally or, you know, a DVD with the glasses built in with it. You should talk about those 3D glasses again.
Absolutely, yeah. No, the 3D glasses, so they were produced by the same company that made the Jonas Brothers and Hannah Montana 3D movies back in, like, I think it was like a mid-2000s.
So good.
I remember working at a video store, Pacific DVD and Video.
Yeah.
I was there for like, 13 or 14 years.
Wow.
That was my work experience thing from, I was walking up there. Since I was 5 years old, that was like the first place I was allowed to walk to by myself, because my mom trusted the manager there. She would be my manager later on. But anyways, I was working there. We had to actually put an individual code on each of those 3D glasses.
Oh.
So I had my hands on a lot of those things, which is, I mean, thinking about it now, it's pretty unsanitary, but that's why I wanted everyone to have their own pair.
Yes.
Because we were renting them out. But I was fascinated with them at the time, and I figured out which company made them, tracked them down, messaged them, and got a few hundred pairs made.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Are they a local company? Are they in LA?
They are... don't know where they're at, but they're somewhere in the States, not LA though. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, because I actually ordered them about 4 years ago when I figured out I could make this in 3D. So I just immediately, I had the opportunity to order them. I was working at the time, and had the money to spend on that, and I was like, let's do it.
Absolutely.
It was the first kind of real investment in the film. Apart from all the time.
Yeah. There were a few other physical goods that were available at the screening. I got a couple of them. I have a pair of glasses. I have a few buttons as well. Those were awesome. There was a Roach black button, and then there's a cool smaller red button with the logo of the main character's ship, or the main character's ship design on there, flying.
Yeah.
Then there were also posters available in the back that were done by one of your compatriots who does kind of screen printing, photocopy, Xerox vibes.
Tommy Wilson, I was so stoked that he said yes to making a flyer for the show, because he traditionally does, he's from New Sweat, hardcore band in Vancouver. They're awesome. Check them out. He designs for 625 Thrash. And,
nice.
His visuals are so... they're so awesome. So when I messaged him, I'm like, hey, how do you feel about doing the poster for this this show? That's now, if you go on Letterboxd, that's the one that's the main poster on there. Mm-hmm. And every time I see it, I just get this jolt of like, oh my god. And we're gonna be selling them through my website in a couple months or so. We're gonna try to set that up pretty soon here.
Nice.
On the note of distribution, we actually have 100 VHS tapes
Oh man.
You're going to have both the classic red version that you can watch right now on Instagram. By the way, please go on Instagram, watch that, and then leave a review on Letterboxd. I would really appreciate that. That's a huge thing. If everyone can review it on Letterboxd.
I made an account. I just need to write my review.
Thank you so much. As silly as that website can be, it's great for kind of spreading the word.
Absolutely.
And already I've been seeing some really cool results. And yeah, no, it's just great for that. But yeah, we have limited edition VHS tapes in the works. Right now we're getting the covers made. It's got one of my favorite, Tommy Wilson said he called the movie Dadaist Tron.
Nice.
Which I was like, oh, can't that's have that good cover. He's like yeah, no, absolutely. So
my takeaway, yes. I think I told this on the interview, my takeaway was Gaspard Noé meets Mobius meets Wii demo homebrew software,
man, which was like that blows my mind.
Yeah, that's gonna be the letterbox. So please everybody go review the film because it is absolutely worth a watch, and on Instagram as well. Maybe can you talk about kind of the pitfalls and also successes of making something in 3D and kind of how that is projected, how it's made, what are the background processes of making something in 3D?
Right on. So the coolest thing about this is everyone has the power to make a 3D film with After Effects. And there's a bunch of other ways too. If you just go on YouTube, again, YouTube is the best film school I've ever had. So I've been actually figuring out how to do it with cameras as well. But you can do it in After Effects pretty much natively. And once I figured that out, I just pumped the gas on that because I knew that I had decided on a very limited or minimal kind of compositions and, and amount of assets that I was using on screen. So I knew that with those kind of stark, high contrast images, I could play with depth and have it really pop.
Absolutely.
That said, working in 3D and you know, kind of just, I guess learning from YouTube has its limitations in that, you know, you're going to get the kind of core, this is how you do things, but
yeah,
it might not set you up for things like, you know, if you accidentally mess up your eyes. You know, I did that a bunch of times because, you know, the movie's pretty heavy on strobes. I really love strobes and flicker and stuff, and I use that as one of my ingredients. But playing with that in After Effects and cranking that to 11... I had some moments where I had to lie down on the couch for a few
Yeah,
moments.
There certainly was the photosensitive and seizure warning for those who are sensitive. We'll just put that out there. Everyone, if you do suffer from that, please be exercise discretion and caution when watching
the
film.
Yeah, and it's on the Instagram post as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, just watch with caution.
However, that being said, I friggin' loved it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love, I have a post earlier on Instagram, sorry to keep mentioning Instagram, but I really love
it. Please do, mention it more.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, the fact that I was able to, it was kind of a fluke that I fit the whole movie onto there, but once I did, the reach of having, I mean, it's so hard to ask people to jump from one platform to the other, so having it on Instagram has been so easy to, you know, share as a story.
Yep.
Or kind of send to your friends, and I've just seen the view count increasing like crazy. I'm learning how to use hashtags and all this
stuff. Yes, it's big.
But it's like, it all kind of plays into it. So, the
marketing of the film is such a huge part of things these days, especially for independent productions. You rely on the audience. Yeah, absolutely. That's, I mean, just full disclosure for people who are interested in Radioland, I've never paid for a paid advertisement on Bitcoover. I've never asked people to like the thing on there. It's always been people talking about the show and hearing about it. And I may have invited people to like it after a conversation, but I haven't been like, you should like the program. It's more about like, let's make a good, you know, a good series of content, a 3D movie, a good program on the radio, and then people are going to come to that again and again because they see that it stands out. So
absolutely. And it's tough, right? Like I was also, I think because I was tagging everyone involved in the movie constantly while promoting the event and everything. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, after a while, I think I apologized to everyone going, I'm sorry for being so annoying. Everyone's like, you know, this is part of the game, right? You just have to be annoying at the very worst. Like,
it's true.
They're going to mute you or unfollow you, but, you know, whatever.